Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for standing by, and welcome to the Health Insurance Exchanges and the Affordable Care Act of 2010 webinar. During the presentation, all participants will be in a listen-only mode. If you would like to ask a question during the presentation, please use the chat feature located in the lower left corner of your screen. If you need to reach an operator at any time, please press star zero. As a reminder, this conference is being recorded Thursday, November 4th, 2010, and I would now like to turn the conference over to Sarah Collins, Vice President at Commonwealth Fund. Please go ahead.
Good afternoon. I want to welcome you to our second webinar in a fund webinar series aimed at exploring key issues in implementing the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act. We are pleased to welcome as our co-sponsors the National Academy for State Health Policy and Women in Government. Today's webinar will focus on the new state insurance exchanges under the Affordable Care Act. The fund has released two reports on key issues in exchange implementation under the law by Timothy Jost. Tim is the Robert L. Willett Family Professor of Law at Washington and Lee University School of Law, and he joins us today to discuss recommendations from his latest report. Both reports are available on the Commonwealth Fund's website at www.commonwealthfund.org. Also joining us today are Michael McRae, Director of the Illinois Department of Insurance and Co-Chair of the National Association of Insurance Commissioners Work Group on Exchanges, and Sandra Shuri. Sandra is Advisor, Healthcare Reform Implementation at the California Health and Human Services Agency. Sandra has been a key advisor on California's new insurance exchange law. The presenter's slides will be posted for download on our website today, and there will also be a recording of the webinar posted tomorrow. I'm going to make just a few brief comments on the key provisions in the Affordable Care Act regarding the exchanges. The exchanges will be new regulated marketplaces where individuals without employer coverage and small employers can purchase health insurance, much of it subsidized. The Department of Health and Human Services will shortly issue standards and rules for the exchanges. 48 states now have planning grants and are working with HHS to plan their exchanges. The exchanges will play a very critical role in covering the 32 million people who are expected to gain coverage under the law. An estimated 16 million uninsured people will gain coverage through Medicaid. 16 million more uninsured will gain coverage through the exchange or employer plans. Those newly covered in the exchange are estimated to be joined by about 8 million people who will shift from the individual market and employer plans. Health plans sold through the exchanges will include a federally defined essential benefit package and will vary by cost sharing responsibility, ranging from higher cost sharing in the bronze plans to gradually lower cost sharing in the silver, gold, and platinum plans. People with incomes up to 400% of poverty without employer or public coverage will be eligible for sliding scale tax credits that cap premium costs from 2% of income up to 9.5%. Cost-sharing credits and limits on out-of-pocket costs, also on a sliding scale, will reduce cost exposure for low- and moderate-income families. In terms of the law's key provisions, each state must establish an individual and small group exchange, but they can merge the two. HHS will operate exchanges in states that elect not to operate their own. The new market rules under the Affordable Care Act will be the same inside and outside the exchanges, and the essential benefit standard also has to be provided by plans both inside and outside. Plans sold through the exchanges will be known as qualified health plans, and they will be certified by the exchanges. Qualified health plans, or QHPs, must sell plans at the silver and gold levels at least. Plans selling outside do not face that requirement. Small businesses with up to 50 to 100 employees, 100 by 2016, can offer plans to their employees through the exchanges. States can open the exchanges to employers with 100 or more workers in 2017. Premium and cost-sharing tax credits and small employer tax credits can only be used for plans purchased through the exchanges. HHS will establish a risk adjustment mechanism that will compensate carriers with sicker than average enrollees. And I'm going to stop here and turn this over to Tim Jost. Tim?
Thank you. As Sarah mentioned, my reports are up at the Commonwealth Fund website, and I'm going to focus today on the second of my reports, which is dealing with eight difficult issues. that HHS and the states must address in establishing exchanges. The first issue the states are going to have to address is governance. Under the Affordable Care Act, states can either establish the exchange in a state agency or can establish a nonprofit agency to run it. I recommend that the exchange should be placed in a state agency and that it be an independent agency, which would be subject to administrative law, but would be explicitly accepted, perhaps, from some of the requirements of state government operations requirements as necessary. The governing board of the exchange should represent state agencies with which the exchange must work and could also include interested parties who don't have a conflict of interest and persons with relevant expertise. Management, on the other hand, should be apolitical and professional. Exchanges should contract out services for which a competitive market exists and for which performance can be readily monitored, such as some IT functions. Exchanges can, under the Affordable Care Act, be placed by the states with a private nonprofit, but that raises some difficult problems regarding public accountability, ERISA fiduciary obligations, and in some states with state constitutional law, and I would advise against that. The biggest challenge the exchanges face is going to be adverse selection. States should regulate the individual and small group market outside the exchange identically to the market inside the exchange to the extent possible to avoid this. Some states may be able to eliminate the market outside the exchange, although the fact that unlawful aliens can purchase only through the exchange may make this impossible. Much will also turn on the risk adjustment system, which HHS must provide criteria for and the states must operate. Risk adjustment is needed not only to protect the exchange against adverse selection, but also to discourage adverse selection within the exchange. In the long run, it would be advantageous for states to expand beyond the 100 member employee groups that they can cover up till 2016 to increase their market power and achieve economies of scale. If they do so, however, they face a real threat of adverse selection from self-insured plans, which can remain outside the exchange and outside of state regulation as long as their employers are healthy and then dump their employees into the exchange when they cease to be so. The Department of Labor and Treasury, I believe, should define self-insured status more clearly to clarify that only employers who are truly capable of bearing and do in fact bear substantial risk of the cost of health insurance for their groups can qualify for self-insured status. States should also consider extending the requirements of the Affordable Care Act to large plans and to grandfathered plans that qualify for exchange coverage, but should try to come up with ways to keep self-insured plans and large plans from adversely selecting against the exchange. Another major issue states will struggle with is how to make the shop exchange work for employers. It is essential that that exchanges offer employers the possibility of an aggregated or consolidated bill covering the premiums of all of their employees. Employers should be able to pay either a fixed percentage of the premium for all employees for a specified level of coverage, with the employee covering the remainder of the premium, or to charge employees a premium share based on category and richness of coverage. One of the biggest issues, one of the biggest decisions states will have to make is whether the exchange will be an active purchaser or not. Exchanges must use their certification power to assure that health plans in fact meet the statutory requirements for qualified health plans and that plans do not impose unreasonable premium increases on their members. Exchanges should at least have the possibility of being an active purchaser as well, as is true under the new California bill, which I assume we'll hear about. Exchanges should decide whether to take a more inclusive or exclusive approach to insurer participation based on the conditions in their own state and local markets. Recent experience with Medicare Advantage premiums, however, shows that active involvement in the purchasing process can result in real increase in value. Exchanges should also standardize, I believe, and limit the range of plan choices available within each tier to help consumers focus competition on price and value. A major function of the exchanges is to disclose and produce information. This will be both descriptive and evaluative information. Exchanges should develop rating systems that permit accurate comparison of the value of completing plans and satisfaction survey programs that pay particular attention to the opinions of plan members who have serious health problems or financial problems related to their health needs. Another major and very complicated function of the exchanges will be to help people apply for tax credits. Although the Affordable Care Act includes extensive provisions describing how eligibility for premium tax credits and cost-sharing reductions, as well as for Medicaid and CHIP, are to be determined, in the end, the allocation of responsibility on the practical level remains unclear. The statute should be implemented so that an individual can apply either to the exchange or state Medicaid agency, a no-wrong-door approach, and that either entity must then make certain that the individual is signed up for the appropriate program. The exchange and the Medicaid and CHIP programs should, to the maximum extent possible, facilitate electronic applications without the need for paper documentation, except where absolutely necessary. The reconciliation requirements of the statute should be interpreted so as to not defeat the purpose of providing assistance to those who need it. This will be the most difficult issue exchanges face, and if they don't get it right, the exchanges will not succeed. The final issue the states must face is how to make exchange plans affordable and how to finance the exchange. Exchanges must seek opportunities to lower administrative costs both for insurers and for employers. They will also need, after federal funding ends in 2015, to identify a variety of revenue sources to fund their work, including perhaps a tax on all insurers in the market. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you, Tim. Sandra Shuri.
Good morning. I'd like to talk with you a bit about California's exchange. We are the first state to have enacted state law in the post-ACA environment, and I'd like to share with you today my thoughts about the three big issues that states need to answer in their legislation. It's tempting to try to answer all the questions in legislation, and our counsel and guidance to our sister states would be to really focus on the big questions that legislation needs to answer, those being, what is the purpose of your exchange, what is the governance and oversight, and what authorities and tools should your exchange have. In terms of purpose, the ACA does lay out what the exchange is to be and some of the basic parameters. The federal responsibility is to support states for startup, to monitor implementation, and if necessary, to establish a federal fallback option. In terms of state responsibility, California said yes. We think it does serve the interests of the people of California for us to administer our own exchange. Having made that decision, we saw there being three basic design options for an exchange. The first being that the exchange could really define the market. A state could go in and say all individual coverage is going to flow through the exchange, both subsidized and unsubsidized. A second option is that an exchange could be a purchaser. It could go into the market, and as many large employers and large purchasers do today, could selectively contract with plans and have an offering that is part of the market but less than every plan in the market. And then the third option is really the idea of an exchange as a clearinghouse. The idea here is that transparency can be a very powerful force for market transformation, and if you were to design an exchange around this clearinghouse option, you'd really be relying on a large bulletin board kind of approach, a large menu, if you will, and the exchange's role would be to make clear the different values within them. here in California, we have a lot of experience in our state with active purchasing. Our legislature and our governor chose that middle path, the middle ground of an exchange as a purchaser. Our state law does give the governing board of our exchange the ability to selectively contract with plans. And then our legislation instructs the board to look at maximizing value, and value being that mix of quality, access, and price. In terms of governance, as Tim pointed out, the federal law does give two choices to states that choose to operate an exchange, either a governmental or nonprofit entity. And the real key here in selecting a governance option is trying to balance accountability and accessibility of decision making with the ability of the entity to respond to changes in the market and in the environmental conditions. So in California, we did decide to establish an independent entity within state government. It's going to be a 5-member governing board. It's a pretty small board. I think when I've talked to other states, they've been surprised at the size of our entity. Two of the members will be appointed by the governor, two by the legislature, and one will be the Secretary of Health and Human Services. Our state enacted very, very strict conflict of interest provisions. Generally, the idea there being to bar anyone that's working for insurers, an agent or a broker, a healthcare facility, or a healthcare provider from being on the board. Our state law contains 1-year revolving door provisions for members of the governing board, and our board members are to be unpaid. The authorities and tools is the third big area that we believe state law needed to address. The ACA contains a number of both requirements and authorities for exchanges, from certifying and recertifying qualified health plans to rating of plans, screening and enrolling into the exchange, Medicaid, and CHIP. As Tim pointed out, one of the very key issues is adverse selection. The ACA is strong in that area, and I think as states deliberate the kind of provisions they want to add to their state law, it's important to always recall what is in the ACA. The individual requirement to both obtain and maintain coverage is a large protection on adverse selection. The fact that federal subsidies are only available through the exchange, powerful adverse selection protection, both of those first two really give the exchange the ability to have a broad risk mix of participants. The uniform market rules in and out of the exchange are a strong piece of the ACA, the fact that we now have national standards for some of these basic market rules. The minimum essential benefits, I believe, is a strong protection against adverse selection, against plans trying to segment risk based on benefit design. The ability of the exchange to market direct to consumers is a tool that the ACA gives exchanges in the area of adverse selection. The fact that there is one risk pool for rating purposes in and out of the exchange for an exchange for a state that decides to have the exchange be part of the larger market, and then, as Tim pointed out, the risk adjustment mechanism. Here in California, we thought those were strong and necessary protections against adverse selection, and spent a lot of our time in our legislative session thinking about how to make those even stronger. So what we did is, in our exchange, in addition to the bronze and silver plans needing to be offered, we said that if you participate in our exchange as a plan, you need to offer all four of the actuarial equivalent benefit levels, bronze through platinum. We also, in state law, said that the catastrophic coverage is only able to be sold in our state through plans that participate in our exchange. Now, we did need to make a provision in the law that said that outside the exchange, the plans that are in our exchange can sell catastrophic coverage to people not otherwise eligible to purchase. This will give undocumented immigrants a place to go to buy catastrophic coverage should they choose to do that. Fair and affirmative marketing, our state law contains language requiring that all plans in the exchange fairly and affirmatively market, both inside and outside the exchange. A controversial piece of our bill, it is consistent with Tim's recommendations, is that our legislature and governor gave the board permissive authority to standardize products offered through the exchange. This is something the governing board can choose to do. It is not a given, but if they do it, then plans both in and outside of the exchange market in California will need to offer those standard benefit designs. And then the final protection against adverse selection is the ability to selectively contract with plans. Let me talk a little bit more about selective contracting. The governing entity is to develop standards and criteria for the contracting. Our legislation instructs them to do so based on the best interests of individuals and small employers, and again, to look for that optimal combination of choice, value, quality, and service. There is no prohibition on the exchange from accepting all qualified health plans. So while the board has the ability to selectively contract, they could, as a strategy, decide to take all plans. It creates flexibility for our exchange in developing what that certification process will look like and enables us to really work with the carriers who want to advance the kind of goals that the governing board will adopt for the exchange.
Sandra, can you wrap it up in about 2 minutes?
I can. I'll really quickly, and since you all will have access to these slides, the California law does provide administrative flexibilities, as Tim suggested, in terms of hiring, regulatory authority, contracting law. We decided to keep our individual and small group markets distinct, and in 2018 to make a recommendation back to our legislature and governor on whether they should or not they should be combined. Our state law contains a lot of provisions protecting our general fund. Our policymakers were willing to move forward on an exchange and excited about it to the extent our state general funds were protected, so we have many provisions around that. And then we have a series of provisions on accountability. The idea of this being an open process that the public can easily observe and comment on and influence the decision making. I have a list in my slides, I won't go over it, of the big policy issues between 2011 and 2014. But again, the ones that we think are most important for initial legislation are purpose, governance, and the authorities and tools of the exchange. I turn it back to you, Sarah.
Thank you, Sandra, and I'll turn to Michael McRae. Michael?
Thank you, Sarah. Good afternoon, everybody, and thanks to the Commonwealth Fund for including me. As mentioned, I chair the National Association of Insurance Commissioners effort relating to exchanges. We've worked closely as an organization over the last several months. We have over 30, I think it's approximately 35 states have been participating in the working group, very diverse, broad cross-section of the country engaged. We've worked with the Department of Health and Human Services very closely, and my recent colleague, the former Commissioner of Insurance in Pennsylvania, Joel Arroyo, is leading the HHS effort on exchanges. What we have found is that HHS has been very supportive of the state efforts and recognizes there's a tremendous amount of nuance and diversity among the states. I should say also that while I don't have any slides for you to view, I will get to Sarah a copy of the current version of a model law developed by the NAIC so that, Sarah, when you post the slides or make them available this afternoon, that draft model law will also be available for your participants to view.
Great.
So some of you might have observed there was an election on Tuesday. There have been a number of reactions among the recently elected to the health reform broadly. I'm not going to comment on that other than to say that the NAIC, which some of you have probably learned about for the first time recently, is in fact a broad and diverse group. There's one commissioner from every state. And we have historically worked to find practical, reasonable solutions to challenging regulatory problems. One recent example of that was our work on the medical loss ratio standard that we developed and provided to HHS, and HHS is reviewing that, and we're expecting certification of that NAIC-developed effort. But one reason why the Affordable Care Act refers to the NAIC is that we have traditionally, as I said, historically, pretty much without exception, been an organization that's been able to coalesce as a group of regulators focused on achieving an outcome as required by law. We deal with issues as relating as broad as actuarial principles to stranger-originated life insurance, and a concentrated focus of our efforts over the last six-plus months has been implementation of the Affordable Care Act. The papers written by Tim Jost have been an excellent resource for regulators, and I have referred them to advocates, providers, and others in the state of Illinois who also find them great help. Those of you who have not reviewed them, I encourage you to do that. The exchange planning grants, 48 states received an exchange planning grant. One of the things that's important as you evaluate national approaches is to understand the vast differences within the states. There are differences in insurance markets. Insurance markets are extremely different state to state. So a state like Wisconsin, immediately north of Illinois, has no company with greater than 20% market share. If you were to come to Illinois, you'd find one company that has nearly 70% of the commercial insurance market. And then, of course, there are states as diverse as Massachusetts and Utah in terms of the health insurance market. It's important to understand the starting point in every state as you evaluate what's the best approach for an exchange in a given state. And we've all learned the differences of Massachusetts and Utah. There are also, of course, the political differences, and sometimes these political differences play out in views of conflicts of interest relative to the exchange. So we heard Sandra describe the California Governance Board, but we see in Massachusetts and Utah two distinctly different approaches to that conflict question. Some states view political influence as a conflict of interest. Others want that political, direct political participation and view that as an asset to an exchange. Again, that'll decide, or I think in some cases dictate, whether the exchange is set up as an independent nonprofit agency or is it run through an existing executive branch agency. And then I was very happy to hear Sandra emphasize the importance of purpose. Many states right now are struggling, wrestling with the alternatives in vision for the exchange. Just creating and establishing a vision is an enormous challenge for many states. States have differences in IT resources. The starting points for states are very different. So enrollment and eligibility, of course, as we all understand, is going to be essential, critical for function for the exchange. Some states have vastly better enrollment and eligibility processes in place now. Some states have vastly better IT systems, infrastructures in place. And I've said this before in other places, Illinois, our enrollment and eligibility system is operated primarily with this family of hamsters that have been extremely prolific, and they have managed to operate the wheels very well for a while, but we need to improve that and are expecting to. And we were pleased, as many states were, to see HHS's guidance on some of the IT issues that was released just yesterday. Another big issue and another difference state to state, the differences in collective action. Some states are programmed for their agencies to work well collaboratively, collectively. Other states, there is more of a parochial nature and protective attitude between agencies. This is very important because, of course, as we all know, states are fiscally challenged right now, and the Medicaid budgets in many states are a significant component of every state's general revenue fund expenditures, and that's a major focus for state government because of the impact on the state budget. However, for the exchange to be successful, as Professor Jost mentioned, the private side of the exchange is essential. For the exchange to function as a marketplace, it needs to draw privately insured lives, needs to draw small employers initially. So as the state has the budget priority of Medicaid, the focus of the exchange has to include the marketplace component. At the NAIC, as I mentioned, we have developed and are prepared to finalize a model law for states to consider starting in January. Now, many states like California and I believe a couple other states have developed already their own laws to implement or establish the exchange, but there are many states, the vast majority of states, who aren't sure where to start. So at the NAIC, we've developed a model law that does not address any of the some perhaps contentious but definitely complex policy issues that state legislatures and governors will have to decide. It's available right now at the NAIC website at NAIC.org, but as I mentioned, I'll get a copy of that to Sarah. We are having a public call relative to that model law to receive public input on November 9th. We tracked in our model law, recognizing, as you can all understand, the diversity among the states, some states wanting to be more aggressive in different areas than others. What we tracked as regulators for our model law was the basic essential provisions of the law. We've left to states the more policy-based questions, and those we've heard articulated by Sandra and Tim relating to governance, sustainability, operations, the consolidation of an exchange for individual and small employers. And there are a number of areas we're still awaiting HHS guidance. I want to hit on a couple other of the critical considerations for the states very briefly. Adverse selection has been mentioned. The rules governing plans sold on and off the exchange, essential question, critical question. This complexity of this question will be exacerbated if a state opts not to operate the exchange and leaves it to the federal government. The fiscal sustainability of an exchange. If a state intends to assess insurance industry to support the exchange, it's going to be very difficult for that exchange to be self-sustaining within the first couple of years. Big question for the states. To what extent can the Medicaid funds be used to support the exchange going forward? The risk adjustment mechanism, how do we account for those insurers who participate on the exchange and some might have a sicker group of policyholders than another? How do we account for that to keep those companies competitive? From the regulator perspective, competition on the exchange is an essential priority, and we can talk about that perhaps at some other time. The regulatory,
two more minutes.
Sure, I'll tie it up, Sarah. The regulatory responsibilities of the exchange versus the insurance regulator in each state. Most regulators, perhaps not surprisingly, are opposed to the idea that there would be a dual regulatory system for health insurance plans operating in a state. Big concern for regulators, the producer community, what we call them producers, agents, and brokers. Not only do they help individuals decide what plan to purchase, but they help with tens of thousands of claim dispute issues over the course of a year. We need to find a way to accommodate the producers and include them in this discussion. The navigators also are concerned to the extent they're advising people to purchase insurance and are not trained as insurance producers, not subject to the ethical guidelines of producers. Another concern for the states. Then finally, the exchange is a new marketplace. In my view, and this is not necessarily shared by all my colleagues, as you can imagine, we are in a state of market failure when it comes to health insurance. There's no other product sold in the country when you have a willing buyer able to afford a product, otherwise eligible to buy the product, and the seller denies the sale. That is acutely felt in many states around the country, and Illinois is certainly one of those. So the states are committed, regulators to this point have been engaged and committed to developing models for successful marketplaces that will be operating January 1, 2014. Thanks, Sarah.
Thank you, Michael. And now we'll turn to the Q&A session. If you haven't already done so, you can submit your questions to the panelists through the chat feature on your screens. There have been several questions that have come in, not surprisingly, on the outcome of the elections, what that means for implementing the exchanges with more Republican governors elected Tuesday and more state legislators now controlled by Republicans. What will be the impact on implementing the health insurance exchanges? And I'll just ask the panelists to respond to that if they want.
This is Tim. If I could weigh in on that briefly, the states really don't face a choice as to whether or not to have an exchange. They face the choice of whether to have a state-run exchange or a federal exchange. And so far, as was said, 48 of the 50 states applied for the exchange planning grant initially. One of the two that didn't apply was Minnesota, which just changed from Republican control to Democrat control. My impression is that, the exchange is historically a Republican idea. It's an idea of trying to organize and improve the private insurance market rather than to come up with a public insurance program. The governors of all three of the states that have established exchanges, well, Massachusetts and Utah and California just adopted legislation, although it's not established yet, were Republican governors. So I think that, it remains to be seen what happens with the Affordable Care Act in Congress, but I believe that this keystone of the Affordable Care Act will be implemented by the states, although, as Commissioner McCraith said, I think it's going to look very different as to how states do it from state to state, and there's a lot of flexibility in the law to accommodate that.
Great. Anyone else?
This is Sandra Shuri. Here in California, we had legislative, Democratic-controlled legislature, Republican governor, really see a exchange as a very important vehicle for delivering affordable choice to Californians. So we're fortunate to have a law in place and see building on that going forward.
And Sarah, I would add only that there will be differences. It's impossible at the regulator level to understand what those differences will be. And not to be partisan in any sense about this, but the objection to Washington takeover of healthcare would seem to be resolved by states developing exchanges independently of the federal government.
Great. Thank you very much. So I have a question. I have a lot of practical questions in several areas that were touched on by the presenters. The first one is on governance, and I have a question from West Virginia. West Virginia is concerned about the cost and continuity of creating a brand new bureaucratic agency, and we're exploring the idea of having exchange governance within the insurance regulator. The regulator will be able to provide crucial regulatory administrative support to the exchange. West Virginia also recognizes the importance of maintaining a clear distinction between the regulator's primary role and the exchange's role in the market. Do you have any thoughts on this approach?
The statute clearly permits that, I think that may be a direction that the number of states may go. I suppose the main concern I would have is that the exchange function is really different from the regulatory function. The regulatory function is concerned with a lot of issues like solvency and reserves that the exchange doesn't really address. But the regulator's role is to establish sort of minimum standards for participation in the market, whereas the aspiration of the exchange is that it certify plans that meet requirements above the minimum regulatory requirements that are specified in the statute, and that it in each case determine that the participation of a issuer is in the best interest of the participants in the exchange. So it seems to me that there's a little bit of a conflict of interest between the role of the insurance commissioner, or not conflict of interest, but just a rather different role, and the role of the exchange. But again, I will not be surprised if there aren't a number of states that go that route.
This is Sandra. The only in California, we do see our regulatory community as providing the entry to the market for health plans, and we have an active set of regulations in California. We see the exchange as a purchaser. So again, as Tim mentioned, a purchaser might ask more for stretch kinds of standards that aren't necessary for market entry. The only other thought for West Virginia and other states is when you have a purchasing function and a regulatory function housed in the same infrastructure, and your regulator wants to take someone out of the market because of bad behavior, it creates a little bit of internal conflict because it is absolutely the regulator's responsibility to do that, but it will be disruptive then to the purchasing entity. In my experience, it's easier if those are housed in two different places and can come to the table as equal partners, as opposed to one insurance commissioner or one director having to balance both of those interests.
The conflict of interest is real, and that's not a vortex in which regulators want to find themselves. We do want to support the exchanges, and I believe, of course, in knowing the regulators in West Virginia, they could manage through that conflict. But it's important to recognize the conflict that both Tim and Sandra have described as legislation is being drafted. And I do also believe, frankly, that many states will choose a course of action based on cost. And so the question that in its premise refers to the financial burden of establishing an exchange is an appropriate consideration. I want to follow, though, and build on Sandra's reply, because the notion of the exchange as a person purchasing agent is an interesting one that where I think states are still evaluating, and I commend California for its approach. It seems to some of us who are concerned about having a competitive marketplace that we need to assure companies are interested in participating on the exchange. One way to do that is to promise a certain number or percentage of the covered lives who purchase on the exchange. Perhaps initially, states will operate an exchange as a purchasing agent, and then over time, as the exchange becomes more self-sustaining and independently viable, we'll see states move away from the exchange as a purchasing agent.
Okay. We have a question related to this for Tim and Sandra. I'm a bit surprised in the post Sarbanes-Oakley that more emphasis is not placed on greater expertise on the board, is not more emphasized in the California's recommendations. Sandra, can you comment on that?
Yeah, our policymakers established this five-member board with gubernatorial and legislative appointees, and then describe six areas of expertise that board members are to have. And those largely revolve around experience with the individual and small group insurance markets, experience in purchasing health benefits, and so they are very, very focused. Our legislation then also instructs the appointing authorities to take into account the geographic, cultural, and ethnic diversity of our state.
Great. There were a few questions on adverse selection focused on California. And a question came up, also goes to Sandra, but I think it opened to the panel. How did you decide to keep the individual and small group markets separate? What went into that decision? What are the advantages of actually merging them?
I'll start and then turn it to my colleagues. This is going to be a very state-specific decision reflective of the market conditions pre-2014. In California, we have a regulated small group insurance market and a regulated but with far fewer standards individual insurance market. And so combining them, there was concern in our legislature and in policy discussions that we weren't sure that we could see the unintended consequences to pricing for either market if we combined them right out of the blocks. The other factor for California, frankly, is we are a large enough state that both markets are large enough to sustain their own pools in 2014.
From my view, that latter comment is the most important one. The question is how many lives are included in the particular market, and are there sufficient number of lives to attract companies to offer products on the exchange? As Sandra mentioned, California can separate their individual and small group markets. Most states, I expect, will combine them. And frankly, my view, at least in Illinois, is that we should do that to reduce some of the pricing volatility that we might see otherwise.
I think that the statute contemplates two different decisions, one of which is whether to combine the exchanges and another is whether to combine the pools. I think that probably, again, it's going to make a difference from state to state as to how each of those decisions is made. But I think one important thing to remember is that the skill set of that's going to be needed for running institutions that are going to be needed for running a employer exchange are going to look quite different from those that are needed for running the individual exchange. Because there's a lot of services and functions that are going to have to be offered to employers to make it work beyond those that are going to be offered to individuals. So I don't know that that necessarily means that there needs to be separate exchanges, but at least there needs to be a real focus in the exchange on the needs of small businesses. Another issue that I don't think any of us have really discussed yet is the possibility of regional exchanges. And there are certainly some parts of the country where it might make sense for states to join together to run an exchange, particularly in terms of the size of the pool. That does, however, present some additional regulatory complexities with the exchange relating to several different state legislators and several different state insurance commissioners.
You're right. And Tim, Sarah, if I could inject that, thank you for raising that, because that is an important reality that states are trying to confront. Of course, in the Northeast, you look at a state like Maryland or the District of Columbia, there's a lot of interest in a regional exchange. There is also in states like Illinois, where in the border parts of our state, we have residents who live in one place and obtain their health care in the other state. So southern Illinois, for example, many of those residents will cross the border into Paducah, Kentucky, to get health care. Duluth, Minnesota provides health care to many residents of northern Wisconsin.
Right. You know, just another question that came up, Tim, related to the adverse selection issue, and you raised the issue of states potentially eliminating their individual markets. And a question, I think there's some confusion about what that meant for undocumented immigrants. People are wanting you to clarify what that means.
Yeah, undocumented immigrants are prohibited from purchasing insurance through the exchange. And presuming that they will continue to exist, and presuming that it probably isn't a good idea to completely exclude them from purchasing insurance altogether, that would seem to mean that a market will continue to exist outside the exchange for undocumented immigrants, if for nobody else, no one else. Now, the statute clearly contemplates, and this is different from the House bill, contemplates that you'll have a market inside and a market outside the exchange. It's up to states to decide whether that happens or what that looks like. In terms of adverse selection, I definitely agree that there's a lot in the statute that will militate against adverse selection. But the statute still contemplates the possibility of plans in the exchange of having to meet additional requirements beyond those that have to be met by plans outside the exchange. It also requires both the gold and silver level plans to be offered in the exchange, but does not explicitly require insurers outside the exchange to offer those plans. As we all know, there are lots of ways in which plans can engage in adverse selection or favorable selection when they choose to do so, and it's going to be the responsibility of state regulators to make sure that doesn't happen, and also to make sure that competition is fair within the exchange. So those are some of the issues that I discuss in more detail in the papers.
Thank you. There's also a question that people had, and this is both for all the panelists and also the standard, the California experience. The question is, I thought the different levels of benefits, bronze, silver, et cetera, are already standardized. What else needs to be standardized, and what is the point of that?
The standardization is simply of the actuarial value. The benefits, all plans in the individual and small group market must offer the essential benefits, but there's nothing to keep plans from offering additional benefits. And the additional benefits could be quite significant. Also, and most importantly, cost sharing is not standardized in any way. You can reach a 70% actuarial value by having a large deductible and no coinsurance or copayments, or by having no deductible and having very large coinsurance. The question is, are there ways in which cost sharing could be shaped that would contribute to favorable selection or adverse selection? Are there additional benefits that could be offered that could do that? And what Massachusetts has done is sort of like what you have with Medicare supplement policies, where you have a standard menu of benefits that is available so that you have head-to-head competition among plans and you reduce the possibility of adverse selection among plans.
Sandra, you want to comment on that?
Tim's exactly right. Our legislature and governor gave our board the ability to standardize, and a lot of the policy discussion around that was with regard to the bronze level plans, that they are standardized by federal law as to actuarial value, but there are a broad variety of ways you could hit with cost sharing a 60% actuarial value, and we wanted our exchange board to at least have the authority to consider perhaps a handful, some restriction on how the plans would hit those actuarial values.
Right. And I have one last question, and it's for Michael. You mentioned in your comments a public comment, and the people are wondering how they can participate in that process.
Oh, Sarah, thank you for asking that question. What I'll provide to you, Sarah, after the call is a copy of the current draft of the proposed model and the toll-free telephone number by which we invite any interested party to participate in the discussion and offer comments on the draft. And that, just to repeat what I said, that call is presently scheduled for 3:30 Central Time on November 9th. And details are on the NAIC website at naic.org. But I'm not sure that we've posted the call-in number yet, but I'll make sure that you get that.
Terrific. And I'm going to try to squeeze one last question in. This is since the decision has not been made as to who or what entity will manage the exchanges, what is the panel's view on the role of employer business coalitions? There are about 60 around the country serving this role or function.
I realize that there are some coalitions like the one in Connecticut that have been running very successful small business exchanges. I think some real grave reservations about turning over many of the functions of the exchange, which are inherently governmental functions, about, for example, helping to determine eligibility for tax credits or helping to determine compliance with the law, over to a private business coalition. So I think that, you know, they will probably continue to coexist with the exchange, selling policies outside the exchange, but I would have some very serious reservations about turning over what seems to me to be essentially a governmental function to a private business coalition, particularly for the individual exchange.
This is Sandra. Our state clearly chose a independent state entity as the option. But that being said, you know, business coalitions have a lot of the expertise and know-how and track record that'll be necessary for bringing up a successful exchange. So to the extent states are looking at that, I think you'd want to pay very careful attention to the kind of transparency and open meeting standards that any private entity would function under, and very, very careful scrutiny to the kinds of conflicts of interest that could exist on the board or on the employee staff of the exchange. So I think there are some reasons to consider it, but you'd really want to put some strong safeguards in your law to be sure you get the result you're looking for.
And to be clear, the exchanges will only succeed with employer participation and employer input, but subject to the caveats that Tim and Sandra explained.
Okay, great. Thank you so much. I think we're at the end of the webinar, and I want to thank the panelists today for a fabulous set of presentations and also for an excellent set of comments from the audience. Again, the presentations will be posted on the Commonwealth Fund website today, along with the document that Michael McRae mentioned. And a recording of the webinar will be posted tomorrow. Thank you again.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, that does conclude the conference call for today. We thank you very much for your participation and ask that you please disconnect your lines.